Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim.
Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. We're so happy to have had a number of great guests over the last several years. And this week, we revisit our interview with John Milan. John has over 25 years experience as a startup executive, venture investor and banker specializing in healthcare innovation across the UK, Europe, and the US. And he has some great thoughts to share that he's learned in his career that will be helpful to you. Looking forward to today's conversation with John. And it's great to have John joining us. And John, we're just commenting, you've got probably one of the coolest backdrops that we've had for guests. Tell us where you're at and we're going to talk about your story.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me today. I'm joining in from my office at Downing in this right on the river of the city of London. So we're looking, what you see behind me is we're looking south across the river to the famous skyscraper, the Shard.
Okay. Yeah, it's very cool. So, I said before we started, that's not a virtual background like we see on Zoom so many times. So, John, we met about a week ago, and definitely looking forward to hearing your kind of your career story and a little bit about how you've gotten to where you are today.
Great. Yeah, really happy to share that. It's been one thing I would say about my career story is it's one that would have been hard to forecast from the beginning to predict all of the twists and turns and pivots. So I don't know if there are lessons that can be drawn from that. I've certainly enjoyed the progression. I'd say one thing I've constantly done is I've pursued things that pique my curiosity. I love complexity. I'm really interested in stuff that sits at the intersection of science, medicine, business, technology, and there's a lot of interesting things happening there. There are different ways of being involved, right, in that area, and that's probably been the commonality. And also, you know, just ambition. I like to do things that make a difference. I like to pursue things that are challenging and therefore rewarding when done right. Those are some of the commonalities, I suppose. But happy to walk you through more detail, but just trying to abstract a bit as well.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, when I was introduced to you, they said you were based in London. And when we first met, I expected you to have a little bit different accent than you have. So tell us how you got to London. You've been there a long time, but tell us a little bit of your story of how you got there and just some of the things that you've done.
Yeah, my accent really betrays me. I'm originally American. I grew up in New Hampshire and spent all of my young years there. And then as soon as I left high school, I went to the University of Chicago. So I was keen to explore life in a big city, having grown up as a country boy. And if you know anything about the University of Chicago, you will have probably heard that it's academically intense. And I was really, really up for that. And so that was very formative to me in terms of the way I look at the world and some of the, especially the critical thinking skills and also the confidence to engage with difficult subject matter where maybe I'm not necessarily the subject matter expert initially, right? From there, I learned about interesting things happening in Wall Street. This was in the 90s, and so I thought it'd be fun and interesting to join an investment bank and get involved in the deal making that goes on there. And so I started off my career as a junior investment banker doing that at Lehman Brothers in the 90s, and got wide exposure, learned how to work really hard. It's probably the most durable lesson I learned. Those classic horror stories of junior bankers in the 90s working 100-hour weeks, that sort of thing was fairly typical. You do learn a lot about yourself and what you're capable of doing when challenged in an environment like that. I also learned a lot about finance and business and Learned about different industry verticals. So that was all really good. I carried with me also an interest to get on the buy side. I learned through working as a banker in Wall Street that finance has many different flavors and approaches. And as a banker, you're effectively an intermediary sitting in the middle trying to convince people to do things. I thought it'd be far more interesting to be an investor who's making decisions around what to do or not to do. I moved over to work in a family office in New York that was backed by one of the former senior partners of Goldman's who had cashed out in the IPO. And he had partnered up with a big Texas billionaire, Richard Rainwater. So they were doing all kinds of interesting investments, ranging from venture investments during the first dot-com boom to leveraged buyouts of public companies, to distressed deals, to creating seeding business ideas. It was a wild west. It was really cool. I certainly learned how to do deal making and how to look at stuff from the perspective of being a principal, ultimately interested in making money, right? Along the way, I was the young guy on the team there, and so they're like, "Hey, you're young. There's this like internet thing going on. Why don't you figure it out and we'll make some investments in that area?" So I also, was involved in some venture investing during the first dot-com boom. And one of the companies that we backed ended up becoming WebMD. I have the pleasure of saying, I was involved in one of the first digital health investments. We didn't even call it digital health back then. That wasn't a coherent theme. It was just another dot-com doing some medical stuff, but that was kind of cool, right? Early on to have been a part of that. And that kind of got me really, really interested in a specialized focus around healthcare. So since the late 90s, I've always been focused on healthcare innovation. Finished up my time at Kirkland. It was called Kirkland Investors, and then moved over to the UK. So there was a team in the UK at Nomura, which was running a boutique basically within the larger Japanese banks. It was a specialized team just doing healthcare. And they had two bits. One bit was doing capital markets activities and the other was doing balance sheet investing. So they had a venture team. And so I went into that mix. I really learned a lot about how the healthcare industry is structured, the different subsegments and where innovation comes from. And so, as an officer in the corporate finance team there for 5 years and kind of got my stripes as a healthcare professional in that, came out of that and went back to venture at Atlas Venture, which is a big venture fund in the US that you probably heard of. Did that for a bit. And then I started this cycling of, I was asked to drop down into one of the portfolio companies where I became the CFO and helped take that company from Series A to Series B and development stage to commercial stage and did a lot of cool things there. Came out of that and became a partner in another venture fund called MBGI where we did medtech investing. And actually, we did a great job of picking some fabulous companies. We just had the misfortune that it was a single LP fund and our LP ended up blowing up. So that didn't last as an investment platform, but the legacy of the companies we backed was fantastic. Along the way, got to know one of the portfolio companies really well, and I was invited by the board to step in and run that as CEO. So that was Quanta Dialysis Technologies, which is what I was doing for the last 8 years of my life before recently joining Downing. And I can walk you through what that was a really exciting journey, but I don't want to speak without coming up for air. So did that for 8 years and then recently joined Downing. So that's the sort of the thumbnail sketch of the stuff I've done.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's an interesting kind of journey from kind of the investment side into an operational role and kind of back again. So definitely some great lessons I'm sure you learned along your journey. Give us a little bit, if you were to step back, I like to ask this question, if you're step back knowing what you know now and talk to a 22-year-old John, what advice would you give him to help him as far as get prepared for his journey?
Yeah, So I hate being overly prescriptive. I also realize that, you know, some of the lessons I learned are very specific to my journey. But, you know, one of the things I would probably, if I was talking specifically to myself, would be to lean harder into going into an operating company startup role sooner. Mm-hmm. I actually did receive that advice very early in my career, but I didn't want to hear it, to be honest. And so I resisted. In fact, I had some early opportunities to step into startups, which some of which did quite well. But it might have been an interesting alternative universe had I done that. But I resisted that for a while, and then you know, when I did it, I found it immensely rewarding. I mean, I liked the first role of where was it basically the CFO of a biotech company, but actually, when I really stretched myself to do something that was a little bit beyond my comfort zone. So when I was a CEO, Quanta, that is really when I discovered like some pretty profound things about myself that I didn't know, you know, like the sheer joy of building something, you know, building a company, a product, a team. Also that, you know, I had capabilities outside of just being a technical specialist, you know, good at finance, investing and analytics. So I have to say, I felt grateful that I had that chance to do that, because I could also see that it might have been a scenario where I never did that and never realized I had that in me, or that, you know, the immense satisfaction that that could provide having done it. So I would definitely strongly advise the earlier me and quite possibly anyone who has an interest, not just in entrepreneurship, but even if ultimately want to go into, say, venture, which, you know, is a field that many people find attractive. I strongly encourage getting some you know, experience, time served in a startup, building something. It's fun and gratifying, but also it's really empowering. I think it potentially allows you to be a better venture investor. One of the things that really struck me is I recently read an article in Sifted, which is an online journal for venture in Europe, and the writers claim that fewer than 2% of venture professionals in Europe have any experience in a startup or operational role. And I just find that astounding, given the very nature of what we're backing is, you know, companies that are going through this journey. You know, it's really helpful to have the lived experience of what it means to be on that journey. And it is different from looking at it from the outside. I think that is, you know, really useful experience. And I would highly encourage others to take the opportunity to do that.
So moving into that first leader, the CEO, the top spot, as far as in the company, what do you wish you would have known earlier, as you've, you know, you were in a functional role as a CFO and had responsibility, but being kind of the go-to person, or at least, yeah, you didn't have anybody else to pass it to, maybe the board, but you still were responsible. What do you wish you would have known earlier as far as in that role?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things, there are probably a few things. You know, one is, you know, to find, there's a really interesting balance that needs to be struck. To one, you know, find your confidence to make decisions, right? Because they're always going to be, like if you're doing something in the life sciences world, right, as we were doing, it requires pulling together a team of subject matter experts, you know, across a range of fields, all of whom are going to, in their area, know more than anyone else in the company, more than the CEO, hopefully. But needing to balance all those perspectives to come up with coherent decisions, so to, you know, finding the courage and the voice to make those decisions, and just acknowledge that not everyone's going to always agree and or see things the same way on the one hand, but on the other is also knowing, you know, when to give the space and the time, you know, for other people to lead and not always feel the need to step in. It's a delicate balance, because there are periods, especially in a startup life cycle, where somebody like a CEO just needs to make some hard decisions. Otherwise, things don't get done that need to get done. On the other hand, you know, you get the best outcomes when you have an empowered team that feels they control their destiny and they're pursuing, you know, they're allowed to self-actualize, right? And so getting that balance right is really hard. And I could think in my own experience where I swung too hard in one direction or the other, and you know, I guess I would maybe want to be more thoughtful about that starting early on, and I would encourage others as well. You don't want to be too passive and just let things happen to you on the one hand, but on the other, you know, you can't let yourself slide into being some type of authoritarian figure who's trying to make all the decisions. And it's a tricky balance and probably needs a lot of thought early on.
So in that first year that you were in that role, what were some things that you were doing as far as that you think that helped kind of lay the foundation for your leadership for the rest of the years that you said you were there for about 8 years? Is that right?
Yeah. So we took it from when I stepped in, the company was still in its Series A funding round. So I had been involved in putting together the Series A, right, as an investor. And so, and then the founding team kind of took over for a while. And then, and then there was a need to bring in a different leadership style. And so I was invited to come in and do that. And so when I stepped in, it was still under Series A. The product was still a concept. It was with some very early prototypes that, you know, really didn't represent a minimal viable product as much as proof of concept prototypes. You know, there was a need to really step in and, you know, make some hard decisions about, like, well, what are we shooting for? How do we get something out? Because, you know, what's the right way of organizing ourselves to get that done? Do we have the right people, the right structure? There was a lot of stuff like that that needed to be thought through early on. And, you know, some changes made. I also had the interesting challenge of needing to raise money. the Series A was running out as I'd stepped in. And so, you know, somehow getting that sorted out, right? And then getting to some type of product freeze. And so there was a lot of interesting challenges that year. But actually, it turned out it was a really tough start, actually, because we weren't exactly where we had hoped we were. But by the end of the year, we had got to product freeze, released something with the CE mark. So we got to some, you know, we had something that we could test and, you know, show. We had raised our Series B, so we had raised a significant round of funding that gave us meaningful runway. We had restructured the team, so there were a lot of good things that by the end of the year had been put in place. That was very different from when we stepped in, and so that was a very heroic year, is what I would describe it as. And of course, you know, I was still trying to figure out various aspects of the business. The people there were trying to figure out, who is this crazy American, and, you know, can we trust him? So there's lots of stuff to do, right? But it was a heroic period where, you know, great things were done under very challenging circumstances that laid some strong foundations. And from that, you know, we were able to build. And what we ultimately got to was, you know, I think when I came in, we had like 30 employees, we had done a small Series A. And by the time I had left, you know, we had over 200 employees. We had raised in total almost $400 million. We had elevated the profile of the business. We had developed this disruptive portable hemodialysis system, right? So we'd elevated the profile from this small, you know, backwater UK to something that was like globally visible. We'd done our iterations on the product. So we had a second generation product that was the true MVP, and we had successfully launched that in the UK during COVID, which was really fun and challenging. We also got that through the FDA and did a launch in the US and built out a US team from a greenfield. So there's a lot of cool things that happened along the way. And, like, you know, one of the interesting ones was as well that this product we had designed was considered to be so remarkable from an engineering perspective that the Royal Academy of Engineering awarded us the McRoberts Prize, which once a year, one team with one product gets that. It's not just in the medical field, it's in every industry. So, like, previous winners were like the Harrier jump jet, the Raspberry Pi. So this was like, some people consider this the Nobel Prize of Engineering. So that was quite a feat to have that level of recognition for this product we had created that solved some real problems about shrinking down a big complex dialysis machine into a simple tabletop device. And then, to expand the ability to deliver the therapy, bringing it out to wherever the patients are and making it operable by patients themselves, and home dialysis being a good example of that. So And we did some really interesting things there. And it was a fun journey. And I just love that what we built in terms of the company and the product and the company's visibility and the validation of that through raising the largest funding round ever in our industry. We did $250 million Series D in 2021. So it was just, it was a good journey, I have to say. Exhausting and hard, but very gratifying.
So you've worn both hats on looking at investments and looking at a number of different companies and leaders and kind of assessing people from that side. And then you've had the experience of being in a company. What would you say to a CEO? I think that's one of the big things somebody going into that position don't realize how much of the job, especially in a startup environment, that you're going to be spending telling the story of the company, what you're doing. What are the mistakes that you see those CEOs making as they're going out to get funds?
Yeah, so storytelling is a big part of it. Really being able to connect like a vision of like, because everyone's wherever they are, right? It's early. There's a lot of risk. There's uncertainty. You know, so being able to draw, like somehow, take people on a journey from that to this is what the bright future is going to look like, and here are the challenges that we're going to have to navigate to get like being really able to compellingly tell that is a really and so you know and not just doing it as like a dry technical presentation, but really. So does that, and that's really important, not just for investors, but also the team. Like you really have to bring along a village to do something hard like that, and getting everybody on board. You have to be able to paint the picture of what you're shooting for and why that's important, but also achievable, as audacious as it might be. So there's a lot of that that you have to do, and you can never do too much of it. So I guess everyone kind of knows that. One thing I didn't always appreciate right early on, and I would encourage everyone to: you have to keep repeating it over and over and over, like. In fact, the more that message is repeated, the more that vision is stated, actually, the more people will buy into it. So there is something about that. Don't think that just saying it once in a compelling way is sufficient. The repetition of it is really important. So to the point you're bored of hearing yourself. So that's one of the pieces. Think about things from the perspective of clearly we want to like. Most of us do this because we want to make a difference in healthcare or medicine. And so we're thinking about how can we get better outcomes with patients? How can we give them better quality of life? How do we satisfy other stakeholders? So we're often thinking about that, but you also need to think about, and those things can be very emotively interesting, but you also need to think through how is this thing going to make money? Because at the end, if you're trying to raise money from investors, you need to be able to articulate that the value story there. Like, okay, so we're going to take this amount of capital and we're going to turn it into, basically you have to do alchemy, right? Your goal as a startup is to be an alchemist, taking, X amount of capital and turning that into a multiple of that. And you need to explain how that's going to happen, like what you're going to do to deliver within the scope of that funding to make that happen. And here's then how that's ultimately there's going to be an exit that pays that back at a nice multiple to the investor. And I just say, be able to think through that through. You don't always need to be as explicit as, you're going to get a 10X or whatever story you think you might need. You certainly need to be able to allow the investors to connect the dots to get to an understanding of how that's going to look. They will form their own views on that. And, so be a little bit humble. But give them the pieces, the breadcrumbs they can follow to get to that understanding. And if you're thinking about your story that way, I think you're likely to get to a better outcome.
So part of being a new leader, a new CEO, is working with the board. What are some things that you would say to somebody that maybe is not, they've had some, probably have done presentations for a board, but they've never been the CEO with a board that they're working closely with? What would you tell them?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, right? Like, again, I came at it a bit of a funny way. So I was initially an investor. I'd been on multiple boards before I was a CEO. And probably the more traditional career trajectory is climb your way up the executive ranks, get to be a CEO, and then one day go onto a board. So I kind of did it backwards. So I guess I benefited from having some understanding of what boards needed, right? And so they, you know, the boards need to understand, they want to, one of the things that I always worked hard to do was just to make sure we were giving an accurate and honest accounting of where we are. You know, because the temptation is, you know, there's always a temptation to sugarcoat things, to tell the positive story, keep the board sweet. But the reality is what the reality is. And you can, you know, you're better able to cope with reality if you have an accurate and honest understanding of it. And you know, your discussions are informed by that. So, you know, I certainly, you know, encourage, you know, to always, teams to always strive to just accurately, to have a cold, hard look at where they really are and to, you know, as best as possible, accurately explain that to boards. The other thing, though, is there's a translation layer. I mean, the level, one of the things I learned by going from board level to company operator level is, as an operator, you're immersed in a level of detail by necessity to do your job that isn't always helpful, though, to say a board, right? So you have to also be able to abstract a lot of detail and complexity to something that's true, but simpler sometimes, right? You have to know, like, you can't just convey all the information you have in a raw way to a board. You need to, like, synthesize that, abstract it, and think it through, and or decide what's really important and what's not so important. So there is, like, a translation layer. Because you know, if you just think about it, you may have 3 or 4 hours with your board, you know, once a month, once a quarter, whatever that is. You know, as an exec team, you're wrestling with the subject matter, you know, 10, 12, 14 hours a day. And there's a lot of complaints. You just have more bandwidth to do that, to deal with that. And you can't just regurgitate all that back onto the board. You're not really doing your job, in my view. You need to be able to simplify, you know, triage, abstract that to something that's more manageable.
Yeah, great advice. Is there books that you recommend to other leaders that you think should put on their list of things to read?
Good question. I'm actually quite a broad reader right now. And so I'll just give you an example of maybe some things I'm reading right now that I find useful. So one of the books I've recently picked up is called The Power Law by a British writer, Sebastian Mallaby, which is looking at the history of the venture capital industry, which by necessity then is also looking at the startups and companies that have been codependent on the venture capital industry. And so I would actually highly recommend that to anyone who's either interested in startup entrepreneurship or venture capital as a profession. It provides a lot of deep insight into, you know, where we've come from, why things are the way they are, some of the tensions that have been interesting to see, like some of the themes and tensions that we deal with, that I'm now dealing with at Downing as a venture investor. They've just been around for decades. And some of the debates, you know, they're also philosophical debates about, you know, things like whether it's better to be a deep specialist with, you know, a thematic view of the universe, or to be more generalist and opportunistic. Like, these debates have been going on forever, but it's interesting to see how other people have solved them. So if you're involved in the industry, it's, you know, instead of having to reinvent or rediscover everything from first principles, really interesting to see how the industry has evolved, you know, in response to these opportunities and challenges. I've really enjoyed the book. It's written in just a very accessible way as well. So one, you know, that's one book that I would highly, highly recommend. The other book that I'm working through right now is called The Nature of Technology, and it's written by W. Brian Arthur. And what he's really interested in is actually having a very, very well defined explanation, actually, of what exactly is technology, which is kind of a word we throw around, but probably very loosely, and not really sure what we always mean by that. Like, I mean, and its close cousin, then, innovation, and what is the interplay of that with science and our understanding of how phenomenon in the universe, right, and therefore technology's ability to harness these phenomenon, and how technology advances and develops and evolves. And it almost reminds me a little bit of the idea as well of the paradigm shift, where you know, sometimes a certain technological field or branch gets exhausted, and actually only once, for example, there's a new scientific insight that allows for a different principle to be harnessed, then does technology go off in another direction, right? So you can think of like 19th century steam technology was developed, right? Steam powered technologies. And that got to a certain place, and there was sort of a certain solution set that's defined around that and technology types. But until then, we understood other things, I don't know, internal combustion engine or electronics, right? There wasn't really much more you could do. And then once you understand these new phenomena and harness them, that gives rise to all new technological fields and then how that sort of tends to develop and evolve. That was a really fascinating way of thinking about it, especially now. I mean, one of the things that's pretty clear is, you know, the pace of technological change that we're experiencing now is just extraordinary. And there's an interplay between the technological change and the scientific knowledge that, you know, so technologies, new technologies enable us to gain greater scientific understanding, which gives light to new phenomenon that can then underpin the development of new technologies. There's a really interesting feedback loop there, right? And you can think about that in our field, in life sciences. We had like a basic idea of how genes worked 30 years ago, right? But until we did the Human Genome Project, we didn't really know like what was going on, like even how many genes there were or what a gene really looked like. And then we were surprised to find far fewer genes than we thought we would have, because there are far more proteins and other things going on. And then we had to like work out, well, actually, you know, genes can be like, you know, RNA is doing something really interesting, and then genes can be read and written in different ways. And there's this other stuff now, you know, if you think about, when the 20 years ago, I think it cost something like $10 million to sequence a single human genome. Whereas now it's down to a few hundred dollars. Wow. And just think about that. It's like the reduction in cost, is that like 10 to the fifth power or something like that, right? Is extraordinary. And therefore the knowledge that spawns, right? So that we're able to sequence all those genes, because we have the technology, the sequencers, and the ability to stitch those sequences together with the computational power and then analyze that and to understand what those different genes, it really is an interesting like feedback loop, right? Which then gives rise to a hunger for even more sequencing capability to screen more people. And as we do that, we get a greater understanding of the diversity of the gene, you know, the human genome. And then we have a better ability to like understand the differences and how really, especially around multifactorial stuff, which is really hard to understand, you know. It's a really interesting just thing in our own field in life sciences in the last 20 years, how technology changes have given rise to profound scientific insights, which have then fueled a greater hunger for more technology changes. It's just incredible to think of what's happened in 20 years. Those sorts of things. And that's kind of what some of the, just trying to abstract that into basic dynamics is what this book was trying to understand, which I found really interesting as somebody who's investing in innovation at the, you know, at the intersection of medicine and science and engineering.
Both books that we haven't heard before, so put that on our list for our listeners. What are some things that you do outside of work to recharge?
Good question. Well, there's a part of me that loves adventure and going off and doing things out in the wilderness and traveling around the world. But the reality of my life right now is, you know, I have a beautiful family. I'm, you know, a middle-aged guy, so a lot of that means is I've learned some new things. I enjoy cooking at home. I enjoy gardening, country walks. Simpler, less exotic pleasures these days. Sure. I do enjoy reading, you know, not just books on innovation and technology, but actually widely reading across many different fields. I do feel that kind of gives the raw intellectual diversity to then make interesting connections and to see things that maybe, you know, are beyond just my daily experience. So yeah, my interests these days are pretty quiet and humble, to be honest.
What parting advice would you give a newer upcoming leader?
Well, firstly, I would definitely encourage people to stretch themselves, right? So whenever I've been outside my comfort zone doing, that's when it's a bit of a cliche, but it's so true. That's where you grow. It's also where you have the opportunity to just discover something, maybe a little surprising, right? So I would encourage that. It certainly is clear to me that I think sometimes we're not great at really understanding risk. So there's often a perception that doing startup, for example, is a risky thing, where it's maybe somehow the safe bet to stay in a big company. And I wonder sometimes if people are maybe not fully measuring or understanding the risks. I mean, I've seen as many people made redundant, you know, in very predictable ways at big companies, as I've seen people lose jobs from startups. You know, I think sometimes there's a misunderstanding of the true risk because people make risk-based adjustments and decisions in isolation, right? They think, startups are risky because they can fail, or they go from feast to famine, which is true, by the way, right? But then they don't appreciate that their own the baseline risk that they have in their life is not zero, and so but they think it is, right? And so then maybe decisions get made based on a faulty assessment of relative risk. So that's one thing I would just say is, you know, maybe sometimes make sure you're taking a really honest view of stuff, and don't take false comfort in some narrative where you think your current circumstances are giving you like a zero-risk situation, and therefore anything else is unacceptably risky.
Oh, great. Great thoughts. Definitely appreciate you taking some time out of your day to talk to us. I know this can be helpful for those listening, and wish you continued success.
Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.